In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
What if I was to tell you that oil, the left's ultimate boogeyman that they use to push renewable energy, what if I was to tell you that oil is a renewable energy? Wouldn't that just upend everything? Now, I'm not saying it is, only that it could be. It's a theory that's out there. The problem is we don't know and we're not exploring this theory because experts and policymakers have decided one thing and all other science is heresy. We saw that with COVID. The vaccine was the only allowed answer. This is the opposite of good science. All theories should be explored, tested, and even once accepted should be routinely re-examined in light of new theories and new discoveries. Peak oil is the theory that there is a finite amount of oil and eventually will hit a peak and then start running out. Except there are other theories that the Earth renews oil far faster than originally thought. The Russians, the left's other boogeymen, theorize that oil is an abiotic process, that it's not just from fossils that takes millions of years, but far faster as a result of organic materials as rudimentary as algae gets cooked underground through heat, pressure, and chemical processes. That's why we keep finding this stuff. Forbes wrote about this in 2008. This was before social media and the government could ban and censor you for such heresy. In 2014, also pre-censorship, researchers found a way to speed up the cooking process to convert a small mixture of algae and water into a kind of crude oil, not in millions of years, but, get this, in less than an hour. The green crude, as it's being called, requires sunlight, non-potable water, non-arable land, and air to turn algae into oil. And its main energy source is actually carbon dioxide, which the algae converts into oil. In fact, the algae consumes 12 to 14 kilograms of carbon dioxide per gallon of green crude produced, a 70% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions compared to traditional oil as a transportation fuel. But yeah, let's spend trillions of dollars on the climate changers' insatiable solar and wind fetish. On today's show, we're looking at the economy and especially the massive government spending. But here's the point I want you to keep in mind as you listen to the show. It's not that there aren't solutions. It's that the solutions don't make the right people money. What we like about Jonathan Williams, the Executive Vice President of Policy and the Chief Economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, is that he makes economics accessible without dumbing it down, because understanding overall business and economic principles should be straightforward and fairly simple, because they are simple and straightforward. Jonathan, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me back. And as always, I bring you greetings from this land of make-believe in Washington, D.C. here.
So as far as make-believe, do you have to recharge your unicorn every night or does it last for several days?
Yeah, exactly. You have to plug it in, you know, and you have to have good, reliable, affordable energy to plug it in, by the way, Mark.
So lots of interesting things going on out there in the economy, and some of them are, I think, rather troubling. That don't take, to paraphrase Art Laffer, a rocket surgeon to see that it's not really good news. But because of the constant spin from the White House, it's kind of hard to see through the fog of propaganda that they're constantly pushing. So what are some of the worrisome signs that you're seeing right now?
Well, there's a lot, right? I mean, it's a huge, you know, you look at the inflation picture, which continues to be persistent and not transient and certainly long lasting here, even as the Federal Reserve continues to pump the brakes on the economy and is causing some real damage at the same time. Anytime the Federal Reserve comes in and essentially is trying to stop aggregate demand to slow down the economy, potentially put us in a recession in order to stop the overheating of the economy, that this of course goes back to the Keynesian, you know, theory of economics,
right?
You know, this is the painful side of what has been happening now for years on overspending and racking up the federal credit card through quantitative easing and monetary policy. And so you've got this very difficult situation right now that there's really no way to sugarcoat. You've got still close to 40-year high of inflation numbers after how many meetings at the Federal Reserve where they've been aggressively raising rates and putting real pressure on real estate markets across the country, putting real pressure in lots of other areas of the economy, such as small businesses looking to finance new projects or startups, so that you're seeing a real potential, you know, other areas of the economy being threatened by this because we're now paying for the price of overspending now for quite a few years. Everyone was kind of asking, oh, you doom and gloom free market economists are, you know, you've been crying inflation and saying this is coming for so long and it's not coming. Well, sure enough, you know, it does come. And generally when inflation comes, government is the last person to the party and it's already out of control by the time government realizes it's actually there in the data. And as we talked about earlier this year and even into last year when we saw the commodity prices, you know, spiking, I mean, that was an early warning sign, but now we've got this full-blown inflation problem. And now, of course, the Federal Reserve, by the Keynesian definition at least, is trying to stop it by causing new harm to the economy in other areas that otherwise had been doing very well.
Well, besides inflation being a major issue, and I think we're going to delve into labor issues in greater depth later on, but that to me is one of the more worrisome signs is we're seeing a lot of layoffs and not just, you know, small little portions here and there, but layoffs announced in the thousands. Twitter, of course, had like half of their labor force fired or retired, so to speak. And so that was, I think, about 5 to 10,000 somewhere in there. Facebook announced they're laying off thousands. But now these layoffs are also spreading from big tech into financial markets and housing markets. I think it was JP Morgan that announced they're laying off 2% of their entire global workforce. I mean, these are not small numbers.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is very dangerous. I mean, it's hitting the so-called real economy, right, after being somewhat of a financial markets issue for most of the earlier this year and an inflation issue. Now it's hitting the employment side of the economy. And you cannot discount when you see these announcements, it seems like every week from another large employer of multi-thousand, you know, layoffs. And it's not just tech, to your point. And that sector obviously did very, very well over a number of years. So there may have been some needed correction that we could expect would happen there, but it's getting into the financial services and then back to the real estate issue.
Right.
That could be directly pointed towards this action by the Federal Reserve after a historic run-up in housing and new housing starts and certainly the housing market being strong in so many areas across the country.
Yeah. Okay, let's go and take a break. Come back. We'll have more with Jonathan Williams. Coming up, we'll be talking about some of Biden's missteps. That and lots more. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking about the economy today. We're talking with Jonathan Williams. He is the Executive Vice President of Policy and the Chief Economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC. You can find out more about them by heading to alec.org, and they have great information, including some policies that we can maybe get into. Before we leave the overall aspects of the economy, are there any positives in the economy, and how much staying power do they have, or are they kind of flashes in the pan and likely to peter out?
Well, I mean, it's no doubt it's a very challenging time right now, because even as we see relatively good news on the unemployment rate and some of the numbers on the employment side still, you know, even that is being used as a negative for the financial markets. They see that and they see, well, the economy is still overheated, so the Federal Reserve is going to have to come in and cut rates again. So you get this weird scenario where you get bad news in the economy and it's bad for the markets, and you get good news with the economy and employment numbers, and we are afraid that the Federal Reserve is going to continue to raise rates. So it's a bad day for financial markets again. And, you know, anybody that's spent any time with their 401k recently knows that it's even with a bit of a comeback here this fall, a lot of the broad-based index funds are still down, you know, maybe 10 or 15 points at least since the start of the year. And so, you know, it's a lot of really dangerous times ahead, I think, and especially since, you know, what most economists forecast some sort of a recession in 2023. Obviously, we already had two consecutive quarters earlier this year. And so there was the big argument here in Washington, and the Biden administration tried to put a nice positive spin on what was going on this year. But, you know, it looks like the consensus is 2023 is going to see at least some sort of a mild recession from an overall economic growth standpoint. And then hopefully we're able to have a little bit of a different outlook here post-November that will at least have divided government in Washington, D.C., and I think that'll send a strong sign to the financial markets and to everyone watching the economy that at least the most egregious big government policies are done in Washington for at least a couple of years, and there will be no more massive run-up, hopefully, in spending, no more massive new tax increases, and at least we'll have some more, even if it's gridlock, it'll be a little bit more rational policy coming out of Washington, hopefully, in the next 2 years.
I certainly hope so, and we definitely want to talk to you some about spending, but let's get some of these missteps by the Biden administration out of the way. It just seems like so much of what this administration is doing is not really helping the economy. And I look to those negotiations that really failed with the railroad strikers as just an example of how he really didn't do anything. And the kind of the inaction led to what they had, which were it put all those workers in a trap because they weren't able to negotiate and the union didn't like what they were offered. It came down to Congress just saying, this is the deal, like it or not. What are some of the missteps that you're seeing where the Biden administration is just really missing it?
Well, how long do you have, Mark? This may be a couple of shows if we're talking about the economic missteps of this administration. But I mean, it really did start on nearly day one of the Biden administration, after we were promised that this would be an administration not just for red states and blue states, but all of America alike. You know, we all heard those remarks in the inaugural address, and a lot of us wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt over that. That's what he actually meant as president of the United States. And then only a few hours later, of course, we got the initial news that it would be opening up a new war on American energy producers and pipelines and American energy independence. That we had just seen that remarkable turnaround after how many years of importing foreign oil. We've become energy independent in the Trump and Pence administration. And now, you know, we reversed course on that. And of course, we didn't know into the future that we'd see the conflict in Europe and other global geopolitical global issues arise around energy markets. But of course, that was the absolute worst thing that we could have done at that juncture in time, regardless of anything else that had gone on around the world. But now to see elevated, you know, diesel still the other day, I think the national average was still, $5.50 a gallon or more for diesel. And while unleaded's come down some, I mean, it's put a huge crimp in the average hardworking American family budget. It's forced people to, you know, not go on vacations, to scale back. I mean, it's almost reminiscent of the Jimmy Carter era, where he just told people to turn down the thermostat and live with it, right? I mean, and so we've seen this loss of, I think, of American exceptionalism in a way, because we've become so now moribund when it comes to energy development in the United States. And I think it has to do with this broader kind of Biden war on energy and this kind of the green agenda coming out of the Biden administration, whether it's ESG or the war on American energy production. It's been one of the biggest mistakes, and unfortunately that was day one out of the gate. And it's almost impossible to see the last 2 years of the economy if it's not colored through the lens of what happened on that opening week of the Biden administration.
Well, you know, looking back at how they handled energy, it's almost like people that are advising Biden, because I don't think he's making these decisions on his own clearly, it's like they think when they take actions that impact elements of the economy, it's like they think the actions that they're taking somehow won't impact all these other elements of the economy. And you mentioned energy. I mean, they really thought that by punishing energy development and raising energy costs somehow wouldn't impact all of these other elements of the economy. How do they not see this? Is this a new economic theory that, oh, you can just punish one segment of the economy and it won't impact anybody else? What's going on there?
I don't know. I mean, and they got to a point where You know, now it's this kind of just bizarre scenario where we're going to Venezuela now and trying to get oil from some of the most repressive regimes in the world. Not to mention that American energy producers produce it that much more cleanly than producers in all kinds of other countries around the world that are going to produce it. You know, we're going to consume energy for the foreseeable future, right? And it's going to be much of it's going to be fossil fuel based for the foreseeable future in the United States. The question is where does it come from? Are we going to produce it here with real standards and clean producers, or are we going to go to these dictatorial nations that are just huge enemies of the United States in many cases to have dirty production? I mean, it is unbelievable that we've gotten to this point with this administration and just this kind of, in a way, a religion against energy production in the United States based on fossil fuel energy anyways.
Well, it's like the policymakers there in the Biden administration are wielding the economy to enrich the right people. Because up until the Ukraine war, they were perfectly fine with making Russia very happy with all of these price increases with oil. They were more than happy to import oil from Russia. And as you say now, Venezuela and some of these other ones, rather than rewarding the people here at home that are producing those. And they have really merged politics and the economy.
No, there's no doubt. And that's been a really unfortunate piece of that. And, you know, we'll just see. Let's all hope and pray that the winter is a mild winter in New England and there's not a huge, just acute shortage of home heating oil. Right. Because, I mean, that is a massive problem. They've been importing it from Russia going into New England. One of the reasons why this is, and a lot of people may not follow this, is the state of New York, for instance, does not allow pipelines to go underneath and up to New England to deliver that kind of oil and gas to New England through these very difficult winter months. And so you have not only the federal government and their war on energy, you actually have individual states, and you know this well in Oregon, with some of the bans on exporting different fossil fuel related products overseas off the West Coast ports. But you have certain states now, with the state of New York, banning pipelines even going through to be able to deliver products to customers and those in need when it comes to heating their homes in New England.
Yeah, I think New England's going to be in for a world of hurt, especially if we have as cold of a winter as they're predicting right now. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break. There are lots of jobs out there, which is good because a lot of people just lost theirs. We'll talk about labor and employment next with Jonathan Williams. And welcome back. We're talking with Jonathan Williams. He's the Executive Vice President of Policy and the Chief Economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council. That's ALEC, A-L-E-C. And you can find out more by heading to ALEC.org. So, Jonathan, we were talking earlier a little bit about labor, and we had mentioned how there's been some major layoffs here, both in big tech and also now in the mortgage loan officers and other financial companies. And also you mentioned in the housing market. So are there other sectors right now that where you're seeing some massive job cuts?
Yeah, I mean, those are the top line ones. But I mean, clearly, you know, we're going to potentially see if this weakness becomes more broad based across the economy. We'll continue to see different sectors. You know, we saw some, you know, nice recovery earlier with hospitality and travel and tourism, obviously, with that having a much better season this year than we had in previous years with the end of the lockdowns and cruises being back and, you know, some of the other larger conferences and gatherings. So you saw some uptick earlier this year in those sectors, but it's clearly been overwhelmed by the negativity in financial services and technology and certainly real estate. But I do expect, I mean, if we continue to see profits down, if we continue to see a weakness with the combination of inflation with the overall problems in the economy that we've been talking about going forward, if we see negative growth next year has been forecast, I think you're safe to say you'll see a more widespread labor market downturn. You'll see the unemployment rates now begin to edge upwards, even though, I mean, that's been artificially low for quite some time. I mean, one of the biggest issues there, Mark, as you know very well, is kind of the gamesmanship that happens with the data. And you can spin the data one way or the other. But you know, one of the issues with unemployment rates still being so historically low at this point is so many people have stopped looking or they've gone on to other gigs that they're not part of the kind of the normal full-time 40-hour work week. Economy. And I think a lot of that has to do with so many of the government incentives that have pushed them out of the workforce, have paid people in many cases more not to work during the pandemic than they were making in their jobs. And then, of course, they see all the plethora of other state, local, and federal benefits with now, in many cases, no work requirements to even go back and look for work once you're on some of these programs.
Well, and that's very worrisome, especially I often feel like we can't trust the data that government puts out. I think it's all, again, rather than just straight economics, I think it's all politically motivated. As far as layoffs in the finance industry and housing and all of that, where do those job losses typically ripple onto? In other words, are there other industries closely tied to those that when you start losing them in that finance sector, that you begin to see them in other sectors?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you just look at the, you know, real estate, for instance, I mean, you know, one of the bigger kind of second order effects there will be suppliers, right, for home builders. And so you'd look at some of the retail and you look at home improvement type scenarios or larger big box retailers that are big providers of the raw materials going into housing, for instance. And with new housing starts being where they're at today, off of, you know, very strong years in the past, being way off those highs. And it's, you know, we're not just talking about real estate agents here having issues. We're talking about, you know, the whole building trades. You're talking about not just residential, of course, but you're talking commercial as well. And you have the kind of the double whammy right now with commercial real estate, where you have all the same factors with higher interest rates as well as higher costs with inflation, but then you also have the reduced demand for, let's say, the commercial real estate markets in larger cities, where we just have this new dynamic, obviously, from the pandemic left over, where so many of, especially younger workers, don't want to go into the office, and their employers are having to negotiate to say, or what is it going to be to keep our top talent here? Do we need to give them more flexibility? And as a result, do we downsize our footprint when it comes to physical office locations? And I think the answer to that is there's a whole lot of downsizing when it comes to commercial real estate needs. And so, and potentially commercial real estate may take it more heavily than residential. And so that has all the other implications for kind of the down system effects of, you know, restaurants, let's say, in that are dependent on, you know, office traffic and et cetera.
So, along the lines of labor policies, there's an investing and management policy called ESG. That's environmental, social, and governance. And you guys have developed some really cool model policies that we're going to link up on iSpyRadio.com. And one of these policies is the Eliminate Economic Boycotts Act. And just from the summary here, an act relating to state contracts with certain companies that engage in economic boycotts based on environmental, social, or governance criteria. So, I don't see this happening in Oregon. I think it's a great idea. What it looks to do is block states from working with, basically giving contracts to companies that practice this. I think Oregon would actually want the reverse, unfortunately. But can you talk to us about this model policy?
Well, yeah, we've got a couple of different areas that we've really tried to hone in on, because this has become one of the top interest areas, I think, for conservative free market state legislators in recent, especially in the last year, because up until about a year ago, I think most of us across the country that had just followed casually on ESG-related issues didn't really have a great understanding of what ESG actually is. In fact, the kind of half-joke that a lot of people thought ESG was probably a cardiac procedure up until the last year, where it became really top-line news, whether it was Elon Musk and Tesla being discriminated against and delisted from the S&P 500 ESG fund because of they weren't green enough as the world's largest electric car manufacturer. Or just so many other implications of this, where you hear the horror stories of individuals and businesses not being able to get access to capital because they were too energy intensive, or there was some reputational risk, so-called, associated with that type of business. And so legislators are looking for ways to really stop this movement that's become just so weaponized from the progressive left that it's lost really any meaning. And this is really kind of one of the biggest problems with it, Mark. And, you know, to really criticize something you need to be able to define it, right?
Right.
And this is one of the issues that's the real problem with ESG is you ask 100 people on the street, what does ESG mean to you? And if there is an understanding around it, you'll probably get 100 different answers anyways,
right.
Because it's in the eye of the beholder. You have Mike Bloomberg, who just a story written by the Daily Signal at Heritage Foundation just exposed, you know, his potential to personally profit off of ESG. He's been one of the big purveyors around the country pushing these standards. And what he means, and what I think a lot of people probably try to mean, is this needs to be a way to, you know, transition the United States away from fossil fuel energy and towards some sort of a Green New Deal style energy.
Yeah.
But it could mean very different things to people outside of that space as well. But the model policy that we have on the books for ALEC right now, the one that you referenced is actually still going through the approval process, and it may be ALEC model policy into 2023. The one that we currently have on the books deals with state pension systems, and it's something we've talked about at length, I know. And we've really tried to hone in on some real fiduciary rules, as they call them, in pension systems to keep politically based investing out of pension decisions.
And that's really the big problem here is because, once again, they're merging politics and economics. And a lot of these companies that have pushed ESG and have adopted that, I've seen reports that it's actually decreasing profits and performance. So you definitely want to stay away from those. Okay, let's go and take a break. Coming up, the big spend.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The iSpy Radio Show.
And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today to Jonathan Williams. He is the Executive Vice President of Policy and the Chief Economist at American Legislative Exchange Council, which advises state legislators on how to improve their economy and their state's economic outlook. You can follow him on Twitter if you're on that, at TaxEconomist. And we'll put that up on iSpyRadio.com as well. So, Jonathan, in this segment, I'd like to talk about the big spend. And this is where we've abandoned any fiscal sense anymore, it seems. And it's just spend. And Milton Friedman believed that inflation could be curbed by curbing government spending. Does this government show any signs of cutting back on spending?
No, absolutely not. And that, you know, if anything, though, sometimes gridlock can be a good thing in Washington, D.C., right? And that's exactly what we're going to face over the next 2 years is there won't be any proactive free market items that likely see the light of day and get 60 votes in the United States Senate or are signed by the president into law. But at least, as I mentioned earlier, you're going to see the worst of the excesses curbed when it comes to the big government inclinations that we've seen in this administration and coming out of Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi for the last 2 years. And so, yeah, I mean, I think you're going to see, you know, we've had a bipartisan spending problem, as you know, Mark. I have no qualms at criticizing every party on the spending issue because I think this has been an area of weakness for Republicans. And we have some very strong Republicans in the caucus up here that are, you know, not only just talking a good talk, but actually walking the walk when it comes to looking at ways to cut spending, wasteful spending out of the federal budget, or at least stopping the growth, right? I mean, but then we've got others that I think would want to throw in with some of the big government spending ideas, as we saw with some of the infrastructure bills that became somewhat bipartisan, unfortunately, earlier this year.
Yeah. Yeah, it's insane how they get elected, especially some of these Republicans that just are so willing to sign on to things that just massively increase spending. And of course, right now we've got looming. Congress is looking at another debt ceiling bailout. This after a $2.5 trillion increase just 1 year ago. So
yeah, isn't that unbelievable? I mean, $2.5 trillion, we just raised it a year ago, and here we are having this very same discussion again with all the political drama that happens with it. Then would accuse fiscal conservatives here of wanting to shut down the government or defaulting on debt if they don't go along with these demands to raise it once again. And, you know, Mark, just a historical comparison here, it took from the time that the debt limit was created about 100 years ago up until 1980, give or take, for us to even reach a $1 trillion debt limit. And here we are from 1980 to the present now, hitting the debt limit to where it is in the 30 plus trillion range. And we're talking about increasing it just from last year by $2.5 trillion from the last year, hitting it again. And it took that long just to get to the first trillion back in 1980. So, I mean, we have devolved rapidly when it comes to this overspending issue. And of course, people get a little bit numbed by the idea of talking about a billion here, a billion there, and then a trillion here and a trillion there. Lots of big numbers, but I mean, the magnitude that we're at now in the 31 plus trillion range for national debt is absolutely staggering. I mean, breaking it down to the individual is often helpful.
Right.
And we're right now, the federal debt, and this doesn't include, by the way, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, those unfunded liabilities that are above and beyond this national debt that we're talking about. But the federal debt today now exceeds $248,000 for every taxpayer in America.
Yeah.
Wow. Think about that.
Yeah, it's astounding. How much would it be if we did add in Social Security's unfunded liabilities?
Well, just ballparking it, this magnitude's higher than the actual national debt. And recently, the numbers that I had seen, when you add in Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, it's in the $100 trillion range.
Wow.
I mean, so we're talking about something, approaching, maybe $1 million for every taxpayer in America.
Shouldn't we be including that with our figures when we're talking debts? Why are we only focused on debt as a result of poor spending decisions? It seems to me we ought to be lumping in Social Security as well, because if people actually heard we're in debt $100 trillion, maybe that would put the brakes on some people.
Well, I think that's exactly right. You're answering your own question there, right? If you actually accounted for everything, this would, I think, shock even folks on all sides of the aisle as to saying we've got a real problem here and we've got to have a national discussion of how to get out from under this debt problem. Well, same issue at the state level. I mean,
Right. Any
of the news stories talking about the upcoming budget problems in Oregon, that's talking about the current budget or the biennial budget, not the long-term unfunded liabilities in the pension system or in healthcare promises.
Yeah, well, that's exactly where I was going to go, is because this $100 trillion debt, that's just at the national level. And that doesn't even include what you're seeing at the state level. I didn't know that Oregon had, they've got that national debt clock. I didn't know that they had one for individual states as well. And we'll put that link up on iSpyReader.com if you want to go check it. But Oregon's debt clock stands right now at $48.5 billion. So that's another $11,000 per person. And our debt to GDP ratio within this state is 17.6%. So it's just this massive amount of money that we owe to everybody. What would happen if they refused to raise the debt ceiling?
Well, yeah, I mean, in D.C., I mean, there would be the discussion around, there's some short-term measures that Treasury can do to kind of move money around for a period of time, but then there would be the discussion around, would that be a full default on the debt, right? I mean, and that's been the kind of the fear that's been used to keep folks from in Congress to continue to raise the debt level instead of talking about let's just cut spending. Right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's no reason to ever have a discussion, though, around a default on national debt. There's one very clear solution that is not being pursued, and that is let's just cut spending. Let's not get to the debt limit, and let's not keep having this charade around this debt limit and the potential default on the national debt, which we know is not going to happen. Let's do the common sense thing that any family or any business would have to do, and let's actually cut expenditures for a time.
Right. What exactly would a default mean?
Well, it wouldn't be paying the interest payments, right? I mean, so you've had these examples in other countries where Argentina and others have stopped making payments on debt. And of course, then that creates a whole lot of geopolitical problems and a potential credit worthiness for future debt offerings that a lot of folks are pretty nervous about lending out to someone who has not made good on their promises. I mean, there was a discussion at the beginning of the war in Ukraine with Russia defaulting on some of its debt payments. And so, I mean, this is not unprecedented. It's just unprecedented in terms of modern U.S. history.
Hmm. Okay, let's go ahead and take a break. Coming up, we'll continue our discussion with Jonathan Williams. Everyone stay with us. And back, we're talking about the economy today. We're doing that with Jonathan Williams. He is the Executive Vice President of Policy and the Chief Economist at American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, A-L-E-C. You can find out more by heading to alec.org. So, Jonathan, in the time that we have left here, we've got two segments with you. Looking ahead, we just got done talking about this huge national debt problem that we've got. Where realistically could the federal government be tightening its belt, and how much could we save if we just really got serious about not exceeding our expenses?
Well, there's a couple of ways, right? I mean, there's a lot of waste that's out there currently baked in the cake. There's no doubt about that. I mean, including we're continuing down, you know, the pandemic era emergency type spending programs well after we've seen even this administration declare that the pandemic is over. I mean, so some clear areas there that you can, you know, claw back. I mean, there's a lot of money that's in the queue right now that's still going to go out to state and local governments, for instance, based on the ARPA bill or even the inflation reduction, so-called Inflation Reduction Act. There's a lot of payments there that, you know, have not been made yet, right? I mean, and a lot of that's based around a crisis type scenario that it was appropriated by Congress and signed into law. I mean, then you get into more of the just egregious ideas of why in the world is government in these areas to start with, right? Areas like the pig book is a great example. The Citizens Against Government Waste every year puts out a long list of examples of how government grants are going to pay for things like, you know, mosquito breeding in California. And, you know, just those insane examples that we have to question the sanity of anybody putting together a budget with that.
Right.
And then you have the broader picture questions of going back to the Reagan administration and others to ask, you know, what is really the federal government's role in education? And why do we have a federal Department of Education when education decisions are best made at the state and local level, right? And so you have broad swaths that could be federalized and set, or not federalized, but utilize federalism to send them back to decentralize control out of Washington and give it to the states and local units of government. So you're talking about large numbers and when you're talking about huge agencies there. But I think probably the more pragmatic approach is, well, let's just control the growth of spending, right? And that is, even if you said we can't get rid of an agency this year for a while, we can't get rid of some of these other programs that maybe already are baked into the cake, how can we slow the rate of growth of spending? Mm-hmm. And that's, of course, what's worked at the state level. You know very well, I'm a huge fan of Colorado's Taxpayers' Bill of Rights.
Yes.
That's been in their constitution for 30 years. All that does is basically say, don't grow government faster than the economy. You know, you have to keep your belt tightened, live within your means, and you can't grow government tax collections or spending faster than population and inflation growth. Something like that, that would at least put government growth on a diet.
Why have we never actually done that at the federal level? I mean, we've had Republicans in charge of Congress. We've had the trifecta there. Why have we never tried that at the federal level?
Well, I mean, back to this issue of there's a bipartisan spending addiction. And there's folks on both sides that think that they're going to be able to win elections easier if they give out more money. And they like to play Santa Claus. All right. And so whether he's talking about this issue of earmarks that then for a while were banned, and now you've seen some openness from certainly the Pelosi the House, and then you have now even some Republicans taking over the House saying, well, we ought to utilize earmarks again. I think that's just part of the real issue is people try to connect spending with political gains, where I think, you know, right now the vast majority of individuals that look at things in an open mind about the national debt and the crisis that presents to us all in our way of life, I think there's probably more benefit from people just being frank to say, we've got to cut up the credit cards and we've got to stop this addiction to overspending.
Yeah. So Oregon and other states have gotten billions of dollars from the federal government as part of the COVID relief and all that, the big bailouts. And a big part of the discussion leading up to that COVID spending was the states were just going to use that money to backfill their debts and thereby cover their butts for having previously overspent and therefore not feel any of the consequences, any of the political consequences for having done so. Is that essentially what you have seen that these states did with all that cash? Was they were just backfilling their own debts, or were they spending that otherwise?
Well, you saw a big differential across states, as you might expect for something like this and a big decision point. And you saw some states, you know, buying down debt. You saw a great deal of states, as we've talked about earlier this year, go on a very pro-growth tax cutting agenda, where we had five new states become flat tax states this year, with Idaho being the most recent this summer. So you saw those, I think, good, prudent ways of using the surplus dollars. But then you actually saw in Oregon being one of these cases where during some of the surpluses of recent years, you've seen a run-up in additional programs or in hiring of new employees, and now all of a sudden you look into the forecast and state economists are saying a recession for 2023 following the global and the national likely recession, and all of a sudden there's this hand-wringing over, well, where's all the money gone? Yeah. And it turns out that, you know, we've seen this movie before. Mm-hmm. The Obama bailout of the states led to massive surpluses at the state level. States made the mistake of using the one-time money, assuming it's going to be there forever, and using it to their ongoing programs, and they set themselves up for failure. And then there was a real kind of need for a discussion around the right-sizing of government. And the question would be, would they raise taxes or would they cut spending when they get into that scenario? I think we know the answer to that in Oregon right now, except yep. that potentially Republicans have enough votes to stop tax increases again after this election. So that will at least bring some balance, I think, to the discussion in Salem. But that's not a unique scenario. I mean, the states that have doubled down on expanding Obamacare through Medicaid, for instance, you know, that is a huge area as the, yes. the bonus yep. Federal matches go away as we come out of the pandemic. Now, as we've warned states, don't get addicted to that federal support because the federal government's not going to continue that match where it is today. And sure enough, a massive hole in state budgets awaits yep, for those yep, states yep. that have gone down the road of Medicaid.
Yep, for sure. You know, and the real problem, I think, with bailing out those states is it taught them absolutely nothing about sound basic fiscal policy. So they just looked at this as an endless checkbook, and none of them are saying, wow, that was a lucky break. Let's not put ourselves in that place again. And that's just unfortunate in all of these blue states. I mean, all right, we will wrap things up with Jonathan Williams after this. And we're back. We're talking about the economy today. We're doing that with Jonathan Williams. He is Executive Vice President of Policy and the Chief Economist at American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, A-L-E-C. You can find out more by heading to alec.org. So, Jonathan, in the time that we have left here, we've got two segments with you. Looking ahead, we just got done talking about this huge national debt problem that we've got. Where realistically could the federal government be tightening its belt, and how much could we save if we just really got serious about not exceeding our expenses?
Well, there's a couple of ways, right? I mean, there's a lot of waste that's out there currently baked in the cake. There's no doubt about that. I mean, including we're continuing down, you know, the pandemic era emergency type spending programs well after we've seen even this administration declare that the pandemic is over. I mean, so some clear areas there that you can, you know, claw back. I mean, there's a lot of money that's in the queue right now that's still going to go out to state and local governments, for instance, based on the ARPA bill or even the Inflation Reduction, so-called Inflation Reduction Act. There's a lot of payments there that, you know, have not been made yet, right? I mean, and a lot of that's based around a crisis type scenario that it was appropriated by Congress and signed into law. I mean, then you get into more of the just egregious ideas of why in the world is government in these areas to start with, right? Areas like the pig book is a great example. The Citizens Against Government Waste every year puts out a long list of examples of how government grants are going to pay for things like, you know, mosquito breeding in California. And, you know, just those insane examples that we have to question the sanity of anybody putting together a budget with that.
Right.
And then you have the broader picture questions of going back to the Reagan administration and others to ask, you know, what is really the federal government's role in education? And why do we have a federal Department of Education when education decisions yep. are best made at the state and local level, right? And so you have broad swaths that could be federalized and set, or not federalized, but utilize federalism to send them back to decentralize control out of Washington and give it to the states and local units of government. So you're talking about large numbers and when you're talking about huge agencies there. But I think probably the more pragmatic approach is, well, let's just control the growth of spending, right? And that is, even if you said we can't get rid of an agency this year for a while, we can't get rid of some of these other programs that maybe already are baked into the cake, how can we slow the rate of growth of spending? Mm-hmm. And that's, of course, what's worked at the state level. You know very well, I'm a huge fan of Colorado's Taxpayers' Bill of Rights
yes.
that's been in their constitution for 30 years. All that does is basically say, don't grow government faster than the economy. You know, you have to keep your belt tightened, live within your means, and you can't grow government tax collections or spending faster than population and inflation growth. Something like that, that would at least put government growth on a diet.
Why have we never actually done that at the federal level? I mean, we've had Republicans in charge of Congress. We've had the trifecta there. Why have we never tried that at the federal level?
Well, I mean, back to this issue of there's a bipartisan spending addiction, and there's folks on both sides that think that they're going to be able to win elections easier if they give out more money, and they like to play Santa Claus. All right, and so whether he's talking about this issue of earmarks that then for a while were banned, and now you've seen some openness from certainly the Pelosi the House, and then you have now even some Republicans taking over the House saying, well, we ought to utilize earmarks again. I think that's just part of the real issue is people try to connect spending with political gains, where I think, you know, right now, the vast majority of individuals that look at things in an open mind about the national debt and the crisis that that presents to us all in our way of life, I think there's probably more benefit from people just being frank to say, we've got to cut up the credit cards and we've got to stop this addiction to overspending.
Yeah. So Oregon and other states have gotten billions of dollars from the federal government as part of the COVID relief and all that, the big bailouts. And a big part of the discussion leading up to that COVID spending was the states were just going to use that money to backfill their debts and thereby cover their butts for having previously overspent and therefore not feel any of the consequences, any of the political consequences for having done so. Is that essentially what you have seen that these states did with all that cash? Was they were just backfilling their own debts or were they spending that otherwise?
Well, you saw a big differential across states, as you might expect for something like this and a big decision point. And you saw some states, you know, buying down debt. You saw a great deal of states, as we've talked about earlier this year, go on a very pro-growth tax cutting agenda, where we had five new states become flat tax states this year, with Idaho being the most recent this summer. So you saw those, I think, good, prudent ways of using the surplus dollars. But then you actually saw in Oregon being one of these cases where during some of the surpluses of recent years, you've seen a run up in additional programs or in hiring of new employees. And now all of a sudden you look into the forecast and state economists are saying a recession for 2023 following the global and the national likely recession. And all of a sudden there's this hand wringing over, well, where's all the money gone? Yeah. And it turns out that, you know, we've seen this movie before. Mm-hmm. The Obama bailout of the states led to massive surpluses at the state level. States made the mistake of using the one-time money, assuming it's going to be there forever, and using it to ongoing programs, and they set themselves up for failure. And then there was a real kind of need for a discussion around the right-sizing of government. And the question would be, would they raise taxes or would they cut spending when they get into that scenario? I think we know the answer to that in Oregon right now, except that potentially Republicans have enough votes to stop tax increases again after this election. So that will at least bring some balance, I think, to the discussion in Salem. But that's not a unique scenario. I mean, the states that have doubled down on expanding Obamacare through Medicaid, for instance, you know, that is a huge area as the bonus federal matches go away as we come out of the pandemic. Now, as we've warned states, don't get addicted to that federal support because the federal government's not going to continue that match where it is today. And sure enough, a massive hole in state budgets awaits for those states that have gone down the road of Medicaid.
Yep, for sure. You know, and the real problem, I think, with bailing out those states is it taught them absolutely nothing about sound basic fiscal policies. They just looked at this as an endless checkbook, and none of them are saying, wow, that was a lucky break. Let's not put ourselves in that place again. And that's just unfortunate in all of these blue states. I mean, all right, we will wrap things up with Jonathan Williams after this.